It is Monday, November the 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the crash of that Russian passenger plane over Sinai. Also ahead, potentially tense talks today between President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Their personal relationship has always been a testy one. At best, mistrust, and at worst, suspicion of the motives of each other.
Plus, we'll also look at the tenuous situation in Burundi. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. European tourists are leaving the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh by the thousands following an airline disaster that killed hundreds of Russian tourists at the end of October. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond.
We will have arrangements in place to bring people home safely at the end of their holidays. There's no need for people to leave ahead of schedule unless they wish to. If anybody wishes to leave early, we expect the airlines will arrange to bring them back early without surcharge. But there is no threat to them in their hotels going about their normal business in Sharm el-Sheikh. And they can be assured that we will not allow any UK-bound aircraft to take off from Sharm el-Sheikh until we are absolutely certain that it is safe for it to do so.
Hammond said by the end of Sunday, 5,000 British citizens would have left the Red Sea destination. However, the country's embassy in Cairo was careful about how it labeled those departures. Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered his government last week to facilitate the repatriation of Russian travelers from Egypt. All 224 people aboard a Russian Metrojet flight from Sharm el-Sheikh to St. Petersburg were killed on October the 31st. That tragedy prompted some European air carriers to curb or cut flights to the long-time tourist magnet at the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula. Meantime, Washington is renewing its focus on international aviation security as evidence increasingly points to the possibility that a bomb destroyed that Russian passenger plane. VOA's Michael Bowman reports.
Although much of the tragedy remains shrouded in mystery, a clue emerged from the doomed Airbus's cockpit voice recorder that could point to a bomb.
A noise was heard in the last second of the CVR recording.
While further analysis continues, a claim of responsibility is repeated on social media.
With God's help, the fighters of the caliphate managed to down the Russian plane over Sinai.
U.S. lawmakers are reaching their own conclusions.
I am almost ready to conclude that it was ISIS, that it was either ISIS or an ISIS affiliate.
ISIS has now fully eclipsed al-Qaeda as the gravest terrorist threat in the world.
The top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee says Islamic State appears to have discovered a vulnerability in international aviation that requires urgent attention.
ISIS may have concluded that the best way to defeat airport defenses is not to go through them, but to go around them with the help of somebody on the inside. And if that's the case, I think there are probably at least a dozen airports in the region and beyond that are vulnerable to the same kind of approach.
Schiff said European and U.S. international carriers could be at particular risk. At major U.S. airports, screening procedures have been boosted in recent days. Meanwhile, Russia and Britain have suspended flights to Egypt as the probe of the Metrojet disaster continues. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
You can stay on top of that investigation into what happened to the Russian Metrojet at our website, voanews.com. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington for meetings later today with President Obama. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Russell Stone, the former director of American University's Center for Israel Studies, about today's meeting and the personal relationship between the two leaders.
Well, their personal relationship has always been a testy one. At best, mistrust, and at worst, suspicion of the motives of each other. And it will be interesting to see if they can succeed in putting forth a public persona of at least cordiality. As for what will come out of it, most commentators claim that it's more just a mending of fences to try to reaffirm the agreements between the United States and Israel for supply of defensive weapons systems, and if possible, to extend the time horizon for that agreement, as well as to give additional recent technology to Israel, particularly stealth technology in fighter aircraft. But that would be a long-term agreement that would extend or even come into place long after Obama leaves office.
This is their first meeting in more than a year. Are we turning the page on their bickering over the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, that's up to them. The fact that they agreed to meet says there's hope that they will agree to turn the page. Whether they can stick to it is another question. It's interesting that Netanyahu is also choosing to speak with two think tanks, one more conservative and one more liberal, in an attempt to show that he can address not only the right in American politics, but also the Democratic wing of American politics, who he some among whom he alienated by his accepting the invitation to speak to Congress a couple of months ago over the Iran nuclear agreement.
Aside from security relations, the two leaders, according to Mr. Netanyahu, are going to discuss regional matters like Syria and also the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, moribund, at this time. We've had more attacks on Israelis, some six wounded on Sunday alone in the West Bank. How would you characterize Israel-Palestinian peace efforts?
Well, they are also clearly on hold. We're going through a period of very high tension in those relationships. It's now being termed by some the knife intifada, which would make it another round of Palestinian defiance of Israeli control. I don't see a way in which the United States can get involved in one way or another other than to express solidarity with both sides and to urge both sides to issue restraint. But the handling of it would really have to be up to Israel. It's not something that is part of American foreign policy that I can see.
An Obama administration official is quoted as saying the president, Mr. Obama, has made clear that we're not going to get a two-state settlement during the time of his administration.
Yes, he's essentially giving up on what was a major goal or touchstone of his Middle East policy. He was hoping that an approach that he began at the beginning of his administration of trying to appear more even-handed and supportive on both sides in the hope of achieving a peace has failed.
Will this offer an effort to kind of reset or reboot bilateral relations between the U.S. and Israel?
I don't think bilateral relations on a country-to-country level were ever harmed. The issue is on the level of leader to leader, and that's what they're trying to achieve by this. It remains to be seen if they'll succeed.
Russell Stone is a professor emeritus and former director of American University's Center for Israel Studies. He co-edited the book Critical Essays on Israeli Social Issues and Scholarship. Dr. Stone spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty. Still ahead, tense times in Burundi.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. France has requested a UN Security Council meeting today to discuss the deteriorating security situation in Burundi. Saturday, the United States expressed grave concern over the political and security situation and condemned the killing of the son of rights activist Pierre Claver Mbonimpa, Welly Nzitonda. On Saturday, late Saturday, nine people were executed by unknown gunmen outside a bar in the capital Bujumbura. Security forces have launched a crackdown and a search for illegal weapons. Burundi's security minister, General Alain Guillaume Bunyoni, says the operation will take as long as necessary but should not prevent normal activities by the public. A government deadline to turn in weapons ended at midnight on Saturday. President Pierre Nkurunziza has warned those who refuse to give up arms that they would be dealt with as enemies of the nation. Washington says the crackdown risks the outbreak of mass violence. Rwandan President Paul Kagame, whose neighboring country was engulfed in ethnic genocide 20 years ago during Burundi's 13-year civil war, has expressed growing alarm over the violence, accusing Burundi's leaders of allowing massacres to take place. The decision by Mr. Nkurunziza to run for a third term in July elections sparked violence that's killed about 200 people and forced tens of thousands to flee the country. Human Rights Watch has warned that Burundi seems to be descending into uncontrolled violence. Gunmen in Libya ambushed a convoy of vehicles, taken a Serbian diplomat to neighboring Tunisia, abducting two Serbian embassy personnel. Sunday's incident occurred in the northwestern coastal town of Sabratha. The ambassador and his family escaped unharmed and described the attack as more like a criminal, not a political act. The official campaign season in Uganda gets underway today with eight candidates vying for president, including incumbent Yoweri Museveni, who's been in power since 1986. He faces former Prime Minister Patrick Amama Mbazi and main opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye. Campaigning ends on February the 16th, 2 days before the election. Electoral Commission has warned that the candidates to desist from using ethnic, religious, or divisive language that could create tension and possible violence during their campaigning. The opposition has accused state security agencies in the past of using crackdowns in support of Mr. Museveni and his ruling National Resistance Movement. Campaigning kicked off on Sunday in Burkina Faso, leading up to a November 9th ballot to replace longtime ruler Blaise Compaoré, who was ousted in a popular uprising over a year ago after trying to change the constitution to extend his 27-year rule. 14 candidates are competing for the top job in what is expected to be a hotly contested but open poll. The election, originally scheduled to take place last month, was postponed by a short-lived coup by the presidential guard. Compaoré supporters have been barred from seeking public office. Also in the news, vote counting underway in Myanmar following the nation's first free election in a quarter of a century. Jubilant voters were walking out of local stations with their small fingers dipped in black ink, indicating that they had cast their ballot, many for the first time in their lives. Some 32 million people were registered to vote to select more than 6,000 candidates for both houses of the National Parliament and the regional assemblies. Election officials say the turnout was 80%. International Edition's Jim Stevenson speaks with David Steinberg, professor emeritus of Asian Studies at Georgetown University, and ask him how this election is different from 25 years ago when the military intervened.
The military intervened then because they had said they were going to have a multi-party election. The question was, election for what? The opposition and the U.S. and others said it's for a new government, and the military basically said no, it's for a constitutional convention. to form a new constitution, after which you'd get elections for a new government. They ignored that. In any case, they were shocked by the fact that the NLD won 80% of the seats and 57% of the vote. In this particular case, they know very clearly that their international legitimacy, and indeed a lot of their internal legitimacy, depends on having this election go reasonably well. They have not the capacity nationally everywhere to run a good election. But the question is, will this be seen as reasonable? Ben Rhodes said something very smart the other day at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he gave a talk. He said there's a difference between basically government intent and government capacity. We understand the government doesn't have the capacity to do everything. But if their intent is to limit the elections, that is really serious. That's a distinction that I think we have to keep in mind.
Aung San Suu Kyi, of course, is not able to be president because of laws passed. However, she has indicated that if her party wins, she could be essentially above the presidency.
That is a very dangerous statement. First of all, we have to understand she could not be vice president either. It's not just president. And there was a case in July 2011 where the military nominated a person for vice president but had to withdraw the nomination because he had a child who was married to a foreigner. While the provision in the Constitution may have been directed towards Aung San Suu Kyi, it has had other implications. But her statement that she is above the president, or could be above the president, is, I think, very much of concern. She has talked all during her campaigns and every time that she's been talking about the rule of law. But the highest law of any country is the Constitution, whether we like it or not, whether we agree with all the provisions or not. And yet she says, I am essentially going to be above the Constitution. That, I think, is dangerous for a number of points of view, because her role and the role of an evolving democratic government depends upon the trust of the military. And I think that she has diminished the trust in the military in her by that kind of statement.
It will be several days before we know the results of the elections. Does this create a problem?
No, I don't think so, because it's very difficult to get all these votes counting in one particular time, because a lot of the areas are really quite remote. But at the same time, there is obviously possibility of fraud. But I think that if there were to be fraud, it would not be at a level to really affect the total results. I think the NLD will do very well. I don't know whether they will get a majority or not. I think the minorities will do very well. Minorities will be looking to both the NLD and the government party and the military to see with whom can we ally to get the most for the future.
David Steinberg is a professor emeritus of Asian Studies at Georgetown University. He was speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. And it is time now to check out what's trending online. You know, it seems that at the end of the year, with the holidays one after another, stores go from Halloween to Thanksgiving to Christmas products in lightning speed. Well, there's one store out there under heavy criticism online about how its products are depicting the Christmas season. Our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here with all the hubbub. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. It all started with one man's rant against the coffeehouse chain, Starbucks. An Arizona man named Joshua Feuerstein posted a video on Facebook that received more than 1 million views. He argued in the clip that Starbucks removed Christmas from their cups because they hate Jesus. Let me backtrack and explain to our international listeners. Every winter, Starbucks comes out with special holiday cups. One year it has snowmen on it, another year it has Christmas trees on it, so the design really varies. But this year, the company went for just varying shades of red without any graphics on the paper cups.
And that's what this man's very unhappy about.
Exactly, very unhappy. His solution was to ask people to give their name as Merry Christmas when they order their cup of Java at Starbucks. That way, the employees are forced to say that phrase and write it on the paper cups. He also urged people to take a selfie with a cup and post it on social media with hashtag Merry Christmas Starbucks.
So how's that taking off?
Pretty well, actually. It's one of the top 10 trending hashtags on Facebook. And let me give you an example. A woman in her 30s posted a selfie on Facebook like fewer signs suggested and wrote this. It seems like political correctness, more often than not, comes at the expense of God-fearing men and women. I love Jesus, I celebrate his birth, and I have the right to acknowledge it without persecution or the fear of offending. But not all Christians are on board with this trend. Benjamin Corey, who is a well-known progressive Protestant blogger and author, tweeted this. Keeping Christ in Christmas is completely different than keeping Christ on a cup. Hashtag Merry Christmas Starbucks. Corey's on Twitter at Benjamin Corey.
Gee, I just have to know, how is Starbucks reacting to this movement?
It hasn't mentioned this at all either on Facebook or Twitter. But you know what they say, no publicity is bad publicity. So I bet the company's CEO is not complaining about people mentioning Starbucks over and over again on Twitter. Back to you.
And many thanks, UG. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, her handle is at G. Abby Lee. You can also follow International Edition on Twitter. We're at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at Chile's European Southern Observatory have a new tool that will help them look for water throughout the universe. The Swedish ESO PI receiver for APEX, or SEPIA, can detect light signals in the 1.4 to 1.8 millimeter wavelength range where astronomers say water in space can be found. The SEPIA device was installed on the European Southern Observatory's Atacama Pathfinder Experiment, or APEX telescope, located on the incredibly dry Chonantur Plateau in the Chilean Andes. Atmospheric water vapor at most places on Earth hinders space water search, but the exceptionally dry conditions at the Chilean site, according to ESO, makes it an ideal location to look for celestial water. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, hip-hop entrepreneur Puff Daddy has released a new mixtape, and he's offering it free of charge. That's right. Don't have to pay a dime for it. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the tape. It's called Money Making Mitch. And what's next for the 46-year-old music mogul?
A mixtape usually means you're going to get the artist plus a lot of cameos, guest appearances. It also implies that much of what you're hearing is probably freestyle, was created on the spot, not really thought out, didn't really go through the entire process that one goes through when creating an album. He has another album that will be dropping, No Way Out 2, which he says will be his final album. But Money Making Mitch, this is the mixtape to kind of wet our palates, if you will. And he's asked Lil' Kim and Wiz Khalifa, who is huge now, French Montana, Jadakiss, Future, who is very big, and Pharrell offered up their services as producers. So in listening to this, it sounds very updated, very contemporary, which says a lot for a man who has been in the game now for 20 plus years.
Money Making Mitch is this fairy tale, you know, about this fly from Harlem that came up and he did his thing, man. He was shining on him, styling on him, showing how to do it, showing him how to get it. Maybe he was getting it the wrong way, but you know, the fairy tale of it is most brothers and sisters end up dead or in jail.
Now, this character, or this money-making Mitch character, is actually based on Mekhi Phifer's character from a movie, right?
From the movie Paid in Full. And so he essentially takes the character and kind of flushes him out. And sort of like Puffy, he talks about, in this mixtape, growing up in Harlem, being a hustler, then becoming an entrepreneur, making it against all odds. So it's based on that character, but it is also based on his own experience.
Some of the tracks, it's interesting. I listened to a few of the tracks because it's streaming.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are really, really nice. Some of them, you know, very, very smooth. And some of them are a little bit more in your face.
Yeah, you that's know? The mixtape. That's what the mixtape will give you, a mixture of all kinds of different things. And, you know, again, Puffy has always said he contends always that he's an entertainer. And so he's never been afraid to talk about the fact that he works with ghostwriters. He's never been afraid to admit that he works in a very collaborative way with producers and other artists. So he is there purely to entertain you. And so whatever he's feeling at the moment or whatever he thinks the times call for, that's what he's giving you, which is slightly different maybe from other artists.
And it always helps when you can call Pharrell on the phone and say, can you come help me produce this thing?
Exactly.
Well, if you have any questions or comments about Money Making Mitch or about Puff Daddy, you can send a tweet to Shauna. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also send one to us. We are at VOA _IE. And you can log on to our website. That's voanews.com. For some time now, and I don't know what it is, but girl,
girl, you got me, yeah. Yeah, that's very nice, isn't it, huh? I guess I'm going to have to stream Money Making Mitch, huh? Sounds good to me. One other story for you here. An acoustic guitar once owned by John Lennon has sold for, guess what, $2.4 million. It's just a guitar, folks. Julian's Auctions in Los Angeles described the instrument as the most historically important guitar ever associated with the Beatles. Must be Julian's got the guitar. It had been lost for 50 years, and they say it represents a significant part of John Lennon's history. Auction House said the guitar went missing after the Beatles had a show back in December of 1963. Somebody found it, and it's worth a lot of money. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. So remember, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One thing is for certain. As our collective populations grow, so will our need for energy. And just as surely, as we ramp up energy production wherever possible, we must turn to production that is clean and sustainable. Today's global population is about 7.3 billion people. Of these, millions are underserved, and about 1 billion have no access at all to electricity. So, given that the population will expand to some 9 billion by the year 2050, in order to accommodate the needs of another 3 billion people, our energy output will need to increase by at least 80%. Even in the short term, the numbers are staggering. As Undersecretary for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli, said recently, in just the next 15 years, we can expect the world will add more than 5,500 gigawatts of electricity capacity. This is the equivalent of adding all the power generation that exists in the world today. At the same time, we need to also reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the energy sector by 60% to 80% to address global climate change. One of the most promising technological advances in energy production is distributed energy systems, including off-grid solutions, such as power generators and solar panels, said Undersecretary Novelli. And because low-carbon technologies, such as solar panels, will be easier to acquire and cheaper to run than fossil fuel technologies, she said, the vast majority of those new connections will come from renewable energy sources. The United States has recently committed to providing access to off-grid clean energy products and services to more than 500 million people by 2020. This includes a $75 million loan guarantee from USAID's Power Africa program to scale up off-grid renewable investments in sub-Saharan Africa. $20 million in loans from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation for supporting residential solar in Kenya and Nigeria. And $46 million from the Millennial Challenge Corporation for off-grid electrification in Benin. When it comes to energy, our goal is to ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, clean energy for all by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.